It's Diane. On my mind, the opioid epidemic during COVID. The 12-month period ending in March this year saw more deaths from drug overdoses than at any other time in U.S. history. That's according to recently released data from the Centers for Disease Control. Nearly 97,000 people lost their lives, a 30% increase from the previous year. Opioids and synthetic opioids accounted for the majority of those deaths. Dr. Andrew Kolodny is the medical director of opioid policy research at Brandeis University. He's also the medical consultant for DopeSick, the new series on Hulu that tells the story at the roots of the opioid crisis. Dr. Kolodny joined me recently to discuss this spike in overdose deaths and how so many Americans became addicted in the first place. Dr. Kolodny, we've been talking about the death toll of COVID more and more, but it seems to be overshadowing another devastating trend, deaths from drug overdoses.
Unfortunately, we've seen the opioid crisis get worse during the COVID pandemic. About a year or so before COVID, it looked like opioid overdose deaths had finally plateaued. And some were even hoping that, you know, maybe this is going to be a turning point. Maybe we'll start to see deaths coming down. Maybe we've finally peaked after 25 years of setting new records every year for death from opioid overdose. But unfortunately, the next year, deaths did go up. And then when COVID hit, the deaths started to really skyrocket at an even faster rate. So at least in terms of mortality, the opioid crisis has gotten significantly worse over the past year and a half.
As I understand it, last year saw the single largest year increase in drug overdose deaths ever reported in the U.S. That's astonishing. Can you talk about who is dying? What age groups are they from every part of the country?
So I'm really glad you're asking this question, because to really understand the opioid crisis, it's important to understand its epidemiology. It's important to understand how different populations have been affected differently. That's not just for understanding the problem, but for developing strategies to address it. And too often, the narrative about the opioid crisis implies that there's this homogenous group of drug users who have been switching from one drug to another. And as they've switched to a more dangerous supply, that's what caused the mortality to go up so dramatically. It's not really accurate. And so we do have different populations of people who are opioid addicted, who are dying of drug overdoses. So in the past few years, the skyrocketing increase in opioid overdoses have been involving primarily fentanyl, illicitly synthesized fentanyl, much of it manufactured with precursor chemicals from China that make their way to Mexico, and they're synthesized in Mexico, then they come across the border. And so fentanyl is why we've seen deaths go up so rapidly in recent years. But to really understand everything that's been happening, what we have to recognize is that the vast majority of the deaths are occurring in people suffering from opioid addiction, not in people saying, hey, shooting up fentanyl would be a fun way to spend a Friday night. These are people with addiction. And we have, roughly speaking, three populations of opioid-addicted people in the United States. We have a young group in their 20s, 30s, early 40s. This group is disproportionately white, and it's a group that developed its opioid addiction taking prescription opioids, either for medical reasons or recreationally. And they developed their opioid addiction post-1996, after the introduction of OxyContin, when there was this push to increase prescribing of opioids in the United States. This group that's young, that developed its addiction from prescription opioids, they have been switching to heroin after getting addicted to prescription opioids. And the switching didn't suddenly happen over the past few years. Sometimes you'll hear there was a crackdown on the pills and it led to a sudden switching to heroin. That's not really accurate. From the beginning of the opioid crisis, these young people who had become addicted to the pills were switching to heroin if they were in a region of the country where heroin was available, because heroin on the black market is much less expensive than the pills. And what we've seen happen steadily over the past 20 years, we've seen heroin move into more regions of the country where it wasn't previously available to meet the demand for it by this growing number of young people who developed their opioid addiction from prescription opioids. So that's the first group of opioid-addicted Americans. The second group of opioid-addicted Americans is also disproportionately white. And this is a group that is middle-aged and older, people in their 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s. This is a group that also developed its opioid addiction from prescription opioids, almost entirely from medical use. And this is a group where we haven't seen much switching to heroin, particularly because this group is usually able to get lots of pills pretty easily from doctors because they have legitimate medical problems, and doctors tend to be very comfortable prescribing large quantities of opioids on a monthly basis to older people. And up until the emergence of fentanyl, when the heroin supply became so dangerous, we were actually seeing more deaths in this older group getting the pills from doctors than we were seeing in the younger group that was switching to heroin. When the heroin supply became dangerous, the deaths in the younger group, they caught up and then far surpassed the older group because of fentanyl. The third group of opioid-addicted Americans, I think, is a group that gets the least amount of attention. This is a group that is disproportionately Black and Latino. This is a group that's also older. They tend to be in their 50s and up. This is a group that developed its opioid addiction not from pills, but from heroin. Many of them are survivors of the heroin epidemic of the 1970s. And these are individuals who live in generally inner city communities that were hit very hard with heroin in the 1970s. So inner city Washington, D.C., Baltimore, North Philly, South Bronx, Central Brooklyn, East Harlem. They're in the communities that were hit with heroin in the 70s, hit with crack cocaine in the 80s and 90s. And so in this group, deaths have also been skyrocketing, again, because of fentanyl in the heroin supply. So this third group is also primarily a heroin-using group that's probably been hit the hardest with the emergence of fentanyl. So the geographic area in the United States that saw the greatest increase in deaths involving fentanyl was actually Washington, D.C., where you had so many of these survivors of the previous epidemic. These are disproportionately men. And they're men who, for 40 or 50 years, managed to beat the odds despite struggling with their heroin addiction. They may have done well in methadone maintenance programs, or they may have had periods of abstinence. But opioid addiction is a relapsing condition. And so over the years, they may have had a slip now and then. Now, because the heroin supply is so dangerous, all it takes is one slip because of the fentanyl that's in it, and it can lead to a death.
So, of course, in addition to the individuals themselves, we're talking about millions of family members who are dealing with the results of this opioid addiction or a heroin or a fentanyl. And oh my gosh, it just sounds like it's so awful. I have been watching these series, Dope Sick, and I have been shocked. I don't know how much has been fictionalized, how much has been truthfully presented, but I gather to a certain extent that series is based on fact, and the fact is that the Sackler family did introduce OxyContin and pushed it out on doctors to prescribe to their patients. Is that correct?
It is correct, and I had the opportunity to help out as a medical consultant to Danny Strong, who wrote and directed the series for Hulu. And I can tell you that historically, it is very accurate. As hard to, you know, I could see why it would be so hard for people to believe that this could be real. It's just so awful watching what occurred. Certainly some of the dialogue was didn't come from transcripts, but otherwise the historical facts are accurate and supported in part with documents that have become unsealed in the litigation against Purdue Pharma and from the various investigations that have been done. So yes, what you're seeing there is absolutely correct, as horrific as it is.
And what I understand is that Purdue, with the Sackler family, targeted certain areas of the country, coal mining areas, people who were poor, people who had suffered injuries because of the kind of work they did, and that they became the targets. And we focus in the film on one particular rep and one particular doctor and one particular patient. And the rep had doubts, but he kept pushing. The doctor had doubts. He took it all in and himself became addicted. Whether that's fictionalized or whether that is in fact true, that many doctors themselves became addicted to OxyContin, it's just shocking.
Yes. Well, the character played by Michael Keaton is, I guess, an amalgam of real individuals. And certainly there were many doctors who developed opioid addiction themselves. I've treated doctors who have suffered from opioid addiction, from taking prescription opioids. Something to sort of keep in mind is that what you're seeing in Dope Sick is a focus on the Sacklers and Purdue and OxyContin, and with good reason. That company and that family really did get the ball rolling. But much of what you're seeing there was not specific to Purdue. Other opioid manufacturers were doing the exact same thing. In fact, Johnson & Johnson, which manufactured a fentanyl patch called Duragesic, also promoted their patch in the same way that Purdue promoted OxyContin. They promoted their patches having a lower abuse liability. They even tried to take advantage to some of the bad press OxyContin was getting to help them market more fentanyl, their fentanyl patch, and other opioids that they introduced. Another company called Endo Pharmaceuticals had a drug called Opana, which they also improperly promoted. All of these companies downplayed the risks of their opioids. And something they all did as well was to work together and fund front groups like professional societies or patient organizations to give money to even to the Trade Association for State Medical Boards, to the Joint Commission, which regulates hospitals, so that doctors across the country were not just hearing these messages from the attractive sales reps who visit us in our offices, because I think we would have been less gullible if it was just a drug rep telling you, oh, don't worry about addiction. We began hearing these messages from every direction. We were hearing that if you're an enlightened doctor in the know, you'll be different from those stingy, puritanical doctors of the past that allow patients to suffer needlessly. You'll understand that opioids are a gift from Mother Nature and should be used much more for just about any complaint of pain. And so, you know, it wasn't just the specific products, but opioids as a class of drug were aggressively promoted to us. And of course, as we responded to that campaign and the prescribing took off for all opioids, not just OxyContin, it led to this epidemic of addiction and overdose deaths.
Do you recall the year that OxyContin first came on the market?
Yes. Yeah, so OxyContin was approved in, I believe, December 1995. Its first full year on the market was 1996.
And the claim was that there was less than a 1% chance of addiction to OxyContin. That came from the manufacturers, from Purdue, from the Sacklers.
Yes, so Purdue and the key opinion leaders, doctors who were working for them, and the front groups they were giving money to, and their spokespersons, like Dr. Spanos, who's featured in the Dope Sick, the doctor who got his patients to appear in an infomercial for Purdue, they promoted the message really that opioids are rarely addictive. And it wasn't, they didn't just say less than 1%, they actually said much less than 1%. And they would cite different pieces of so-called evidence to support that claim. For example, they cited a one-paragraph letter to the editor of the New England Journal of Medicine by Porter and Jek, which was a one-paragraph letter describing a chart review analysis of hospitalized patients who had been given, you know, one or two doses of morphine or Demerol while in a hospital bed, and they only found, you know, four charts out of 11,000 where a patient suddenly appeared drug-seeking after getting an opioid while in a hospital. And that, of course, would tell you nothing about the risk of becoming addicted when you take an opioid long-term as an outpatient. But that statistic was used over and over again and cited as if it was an actual study or a journal article. It was even described as a landmark study, and you would have had to make your way to the medical library to figure out what everybody was citing was just a one-paragraph letter.
Some people have argued that the pandemic is in part to blame for the increase in opioid deaths. Does that make sense?
It does. There is a relationship there. So I think the main reason we've seen deaths skyrocket even faster during COVID is because of fentanyl. And what we had seen before the pandemic was a clear geographic distribution of fentanyl in the United States, so that fentanyl was primarily affecting the eastern half of the U.S. And a theory there is that on the eastern half of the United States, more of the heroin is a white powder form of heroin. And in the western half of the United States, more of the heroin is what's called black tar heroin. And so fentanyl, which was mainly getting mixed into the to the heroin supply, it was easier to cut the heroin with fentanyl, where you have white powder as opposed to black tar. But we certainly saw a clear geographic distribution with more fentanyl deaths in the eastern part of the United States. What happened during COVID, and this may have been because there was less cross-border traffic when COVID hit, less people coming across the border from Mexico, for example, that favored smuggling of the more potent drug. And so that may be why we started to see more fentanyl coming into the United States and then making its way to regions of the country where they hadn't seen much fentanyl previously. So the greatest increase in deaths have been in the parts of the United States and the states where there were fewer fentanyl deaths prior to COVID.
What is in fentanyl that makes it so potent and so dangerous?
It's really a difference in the molecule. And so, you know, when we talk about opioid drugs, most opioid drugs are made from opium. And so morphine and codeine, those molecules exist naturally inside opium. And now you can chemically treat opium to create stronger molecules. That's basically what you're doing when you make heroin. You're pretty much converting the morphine molecule into what we call a semi-synthetic opioid, heroin. And when you do that, you're creating a molecule that can get into the brain faster because the blood-brain barrier is composed of fat, lipid. And when you create heroin, you're creating an opioid that's more lipophilic. It crosses the blood-brain barrier more rapidly and is more potent. That's actually when you make hydrocodone, which is in Vicodin, or oxycodone, which is in OxyContin, or hydromorphone, which is Dilaudid. These are also semi-synthetic. They're almost identical to heroin in the sense that they've been made to cross the blood-brain barrier more rapidly. And so those are your semi-synthetic opioids, and they are, most of them are much more potent than the natural opioids like codeine. Now, fentanyl is a completely synthetic opioid. And there are some other completely synthetic opioids as well. Tramadol, dipentadol, methadone is a synthetic opioid. To make a synthetic opioid, you don't need opium. You can make it just from chemicals. And when fentanyl is manufactured, that molecule is extremely lipophilic. It crosses the blood-brain barrier very easily and is extremely potent, much more potent than even heroin. And that's why when somebody mixes it into the heroin supply, the reason a drug dealer might do that would be to boost the potency. Because if someone's buying heroin on the street, they're not buying pure heroin. They're buying heroin mixed with other stuff to water it down. They'll call it cut. Drug dealers will use different things to mix into their heroin to spread it out longer. And if they do that too much, then their heroin doesn't have enough of an effect. So they can add a little bit of fentanyl to it to boost the potency. And fentanyl, the reason they would want to do that is fentanyl is very cheap. To make heroin, you have to grow opium poppies, which is labor intensive. You have to extract the opium from the poppy, which is labor intensive. You have to convert the opium into heroin. But fentanyl, you just make it from a batch of chemicals. And so it's very inexpensive and very potent. The problem is, you know, drug dealers don't want to kill their customers, but it's very hard to mix such a potent chemical into your heroin supply and to do that well without, you know, advanced pharmaceutical equipment. So just a little bit of fentanyl, too much fentanyl, winds up in a bag or a batch, and suddenly you have an outbreak of fentanyl deaths from a batch of heroin.
And there is no way for someone purchasing to know how much fentanyl is in there or its potency.
Yes, there actually is a way for people, for a drug user, to know if there's fentanyl in it, and that's from using fentanyl test strips. And so there are harm reduction organizations that are making fentanyl test strips available. These are the same organizations that would give out clean syringes to heroin users. They're also providing test strips so that a heroin user can test their heroin supply to see if there's fentanyl in it and to potentially be more careful with it if there is fentanyl in it. The fentanyl's typically mixed with heroin and is intentionally mixed with heroin, but there is also fentanyl winding up in the cocaine supply. And it's, you know, unclear, is it sort of an accidental contaminant, which could very well be the case, because if the fentanyl was being mixed into the heroin in the same space where someone's bagging up cocaine or crack, it's very easy that the fentanyl could have gotten in there by mistake, or there's the possibility that it would be mixed there on purpose. And so there are people dying of fentanyl overdoses who may not have even had an opioid addiction or a history of opioid use. They were using cocaine, which is a stimulant. I think a cocaine user, though, is probably not going to know about these fentanyl test strips or know how to access them or even think of testing the cocaine.
If someone is a user and really wants that dose, is going to take the time to have it tested first to see whether there is a certain kind of fentanyl mixed in.
Certainly if someone is in withdrawal, when someone goes into opioid withdrawal, the symptoms are severe. And they include not just the flu-like symptoms that many people will think about if they know a little bit about withdrawal, but they include very severe anxiety. It's like a panic attack where there's what's been described as a sense of impending doom. People feel truly like they're about to die. And yes, so if someone's, you know, going into withdrawal, they're probably not going to, you know, spend too much time testing their supply unless they're very worried about it. And if they're going into withdrawal, and even if they did test their supply, it's not as though they're going to throw out the batch because there's fentanyl in it. They'll probably use it anyway. We would just hope that they might use a smaller dose or do a test shot and just be a bit more careful with it if they know that it does have fentanyl in it.
But that brings me back to Dopesick and the doctor himself, who puts his fist through glass to get his remaining dose of OxyContin and takes it all at once and passes out. The extent to which that drug must drive the yearning, the state of panic, the state of impending doom, as you put it, unless I get that dose of OxyContin, must be the same as what happens with heroin or fentanyl.
Oh, identical. It's essentially the same drug, oxycodone and heroin. The withdrawal from oxycodone is identical to the withdrawal from heroin.
So to what extent are doctors even today prescribing OxyContin for pain?
I think that the prescribing of OxyContin has gone down, that particular brand, in part because, you know, it's got a bad reputation, and Purdue has a bad reputation, and the Sacklers have a bad reputation. And so I think that, and there's also generic OxyContin, meaning generic extended release oxycodone. So other companies with very similar products. So OxyContin has gone down. and I don't think doctors prescribe that as much, but the active ingredient in OxyContin, which is oxycodone, that drug is still massively overprescribed in the United States. There is still no other country on earth that prescribes nearly as much oxycodone or opioids as we do. You would like to think that doctors today would get it, that we have an epidemic of addiction in the U.S. caused by the medical community writing too many prescriptions for opioids, and that we would have learned our lessons. And I think many doctors do get it today. And the evidence suggests that the prescribing has, even though we prescribe way too much, the trend at least is in the right direction. It is moving in a more cautious direction. But I think there are many doctors who, you know, they hear about the opioid crisis. They know we have a problem with opioids, but they tend to think that the problem has nothing to do with them or their patients. They think it's all about the bad apples. They think, oh, there are some doctors out there that are drug dealers and it's their fault, or there are some people out there who are drug abusers who are pretending to have pain so that they can get these drugs and they're the problem, but that this has nothing to do with me and my patients. And unfortunately, they're totally wrong. In fact, the bigger problem all along has been the well-meaning doctors who really just fell for some of these messages, you know, like the doctor in Dope Sick, who really cared about his patients, but fell for the marketing.
A quick break. When we come back, the rest of my conversation with Dr. Andrew Kolodny. And we're back. Here's the rest of my conversation with Dr. Andrew Kolodny. He is Medical Director for Opioid Policy Research at the Heller School for Social Policy and Management at Brandeis University. Dr. Kolodny, we've talked about the Sacklers, we've talked about Purdue Pharma, we've talked about the doctors. What role did the FDA play in all of this?
Yeah, thanks for asking about the FDA. There's a very frustrating history here. As you learn in Dope Sick, the medical reviewer for FDA who reviewed Purdue's application, Dr. Curtis Wright, and who allowed language on the label for OxyContin that there was a lower risk of abuse because of its extended release.
Very low was the language.
Yeah. Yeah, that doctor ultimately takes a job working for Purdue Pharma for a much higher salary than he would have had at FDA. That problem, it's just sometimes called the revolving door, where people go from working for a regulatory agency to then take jobs at the companies they were previously regulating for a much higher salary, and then sometimes to go back to the regulatory agency for a brief stint again. That revolving door problem, that's a serious problem at FDA in general, but it has been especially bad within the division of FDA that approves opioids, the analgesic division. So after Curtis Wright went to work for Purdue, another FDA official who took the lead there, she, after approving multiple opioids and allowing improper marketing, she went to work as a consultant for drug companies that make opioids. We saw that happen with her successor, Dr. Bob Rappaport, who even before he left FDA had filed paperwork for his consulting business so that the next day he could begin working for drug companies. And then after Bob Rappaport left, his deputy for many years became director of that division, Dr. Sharon Hertz. She actually expanded Purdue's indications so that they would be able to promote OxyContin for children 12 and up. Dr. Hertz, the same week, I think, that she left FDA, on her LinkedIn page, she was advertising her new consulting firm with a slogan along the lines of, you know, I've with 20 years at FDA, we'll help you get your drugs approved.
Oh, shocking. I'm just really shocked hearing all that. And yet, as a reporter, I covered the FDA for so long. And what I wonder now is, after all these lawsuits, what's the status of the suit against the Sackler family? And has the FDA changed its policies one iota?
Let me start with your second question on FDA and changing its policies. The answer to that question is that the FDA has not changed its policies one iota. A few years ago, former FDA commissioner David Kessler appeared on 60 Minutes. And during that 60 Minutes episode, he criticized the FDA for its opioid decisions and said, you know, pretty much that they should not have approved OxyContin. They should not be allowing other opioid manufacturers to promote opioids for chronic pain, for long-term use, and that the agency has made just horrible decisions that have on opioids that have contributed to a public health catastrophe. Now, you'd like to think that the very next day, you'd have Congress bringing in the current sitting commissioner of FDA, putting them on the hot seat and saying, hey, you know, what are you going to do to correct these mistakes? That didn't happen. And I think it speaks to the influence that the industry has on Capitol Hill. But we did have a member of Congress, Senator Hassan, and I believe Senator Markey may have joined her, in writing a letter to the FDA where they asked very pointed questions about specific mistakes that they believed were made and asking about correcting these mistakes. The response from the FDA came many months later, and this was after Scott Gottlieb had stepped down from his position as FDA commissioner. And the response came from Dr. Janet Woodcock. Dr. Woodcock is right now the acting commissioner, and Dr. Woodcock is someone who ran the drug division for FDA. It's called CDER. Going back to the approval of OxyContin, she was there for this entire saga. And Dr. Woodcock, instead of acknowledging errors or explaining how FDA would work to fix them, her letter included a very lengthy defense of all of these terrible mistakes that were made over the years. For as long as she remains acting commissioner, I don't have much hope that we will see any change. With regard to your other question on the status of the litigation, we are seeing quite a bit of litigation across the country against different drug companies that make opioids, and we're seeing litigation against the companies that distribute opioids and even some of the chain pharmacies, and all have played an important role in the opioid crisis, and this is important litigation. But something that Purdue and the Sacklers did right away was, after settling with one state, the state of Oklahoma, for I believe around $280 million, they declared bankruptcy. And that got them out of all of the other litigation from all of the states and all of the counties and all of the entities that were and people who were harmed. They were now in bankruptcy. And so what we saw over the past couple of years were bankruptcy proceedings with a settlement, a recent settlement that seems to let the Sacklers off the hook with billions of their money, and much of it was earned from sales of OxyContin. And what has many people very upset, and I believe this has led to important legal questions, is that the settlement included a release so that no one or no other entity, no harmed family could ever sue the Sacklers in the future. And so there are important legal questions about whether or not this bankruptcy court should be able to take someone's rights away from them to hold the Sacklers accountable for what they've done. And so there are a few states, and I believe the U.S. trustee has also filed appeals. So we'll see how this plays out, but right now it appears very likely that the Sacklers are going to get away with this.
Has the Biden administration been able to do anything to alleviate this crisis?
Not yet. When President Biden was running for office, his platform on the opioid crisis looked really good. It included the creation of new funding streams so that anybody, regardless of their ability to pay for opioid addiction treatment, would have access to it, which is really important. You know, during the AIDS crisis, we created the Ryan White funding stream so that anyone who's HIV positive would be able to access antiretroviral therapy. We need something like that as for the opioid crisis. Over the past few years, we've seen finally some appropriations from Congress to states for the opioid crisis, but we haven't seen any commitment to long-term funding. And it's very difficult for a state to get one-time money and build out the programs that are needed, because if you don't get that money the next year, do you lay the staff off? There needs to be either the creation of new funding streams or a commitment to long-term funding to build out the treatment system we need so that someone who's opioid addicted can more easily access effective treatment than access fentanyl or heroin or prescription opioids. And so we have a long way to go till we get there. And that is what has to happen if we want to see deaths coming down. So President Biden, when he ran for office, said a lot of the right things, and he started to do some of the right things, but we really haven't seen him seek from Congress the appropriations that he talked about when he was running for office. And one other concern I have about President Biden is his administration does seem to be particularly friendly to the pharmaceutical industry, so that as it appears that his administration did want Janet Woodcock to become the FDA commissioner, it was with a lot of pushback from advocates, in part because of her history with opioids and other examples of her being too cozy to the pharmaceutical industry. But as the administration has looked for other FDA commissioner candidates, it appears that they want to find a candidate that the pharmaceutical industry will thumbs up. And so there are some candidates out there who have really strong public health credentials, but who the pharmaceutical industry doesn't like. And it appears they're not being considered. And I just don't quite understand why the Biden administration feels that the pharmaceutical industry should get a vote on this. I think that, in fact, if you're looking for a strong regulator, it should concern you if it's a candidate that the regulated industry wants.
Dr. Kolodny, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Dr. Andrew Kolodny, Medical Director for Opioid Policy Research at Brandeis University. He was the medical consultant for Hulu's Dopesick, based on the best-selling book by journalist Beth Macy. And that's all for today. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email. via podcast at WAMU.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Allison Brody with help from Sandra Baker. Our engineer today is Michael Kidd. Thanks for listening, all. Be well. Stay safe. I'm Diane Rehm.